It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes to understand the place you come from, you have to leave for a while. That's what our next guest did. Returning to rural Wisconsin after time away, she turned her camera to a familiar landscape and saw it in a new way. She shares the results in her new book. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural area? Did you move away? What is it like when you go back to visit? Do you try to capture images, whether it's with a camera or painting or drawing? What do you set your eyes on when you try to convey the idea of living in the rural Midwest? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erin Springer is a photographer based in Menominee, Wisconsin and Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. Her new photo book called Dormant Season was published last month. It will be more widely available in October. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you set the scene for us? Tell us about the landscape, the community you set out to take pictures in by Menominee.
Yeah, so I grew up outside of Menominee. I went to elementary through high school in Colfax, actually. And I moved away in 2011 and went to school in New York City for college. And then, like you said, after living away for a while, about 10 years, I just became increasingly interested and compelled to go home and make some photos. And I started making the work really during the Thanksgiving holiday when my family would come home to do deer hunting and get together. That was kind of our big holiday. So the first photos in the project really came from that period with them. And then it sort of just sparked into kind of its own life and its own world. And I was really fascinated by the way that we could translate emotions by photographing the landscape and people and combining the two. And that's a big part of the book.
And there you are back in, rural Wisconsin outside of Menominee there after spending time in New York City. You were there. You were looking at the scenery. I think it was COVID, the midst of the pandemic. What felt different to you being there and turning your camera on this place that had once been so familiar to you?
Well, I think it still felt very familiar. I think I just had a bit different perspective. I think that, I grew up with a very typical rural upbringing, but in contrast to the urban life that I was sort of living as an adult through my 20s, I sort of realized that living rurally was quite unique, or it can be quite unique, and also seen sort of from an insider, outsider perspective. Because I remember when I first moved away, and I'd come home, it was just kind of every day. It didn't really strike me as, these interesting sort of scenes of, my aunt's, cow roaming around the farmyard or whatever these typical scenes might be. But the more time that I spent away, just the more I saw them from, I guess, for their unique value in a way that I hadn't really realized when I was living there, when I was much younger. I don't know. I can't say anything necessarily felt different. I just sort of had a different perspective. And I think I just had grown a lot as a creative person and an artist and was able to sort of translate those thoughts and that realization kind of in a unique way, or sort of distill it through photography.
And when I see art portraying rural life, I think oftentimes it's like, nostalgic. And sometimes it's sort of in the American Gothic, looking mm-hmm. at it from a city perspective. I don't see either of those here. I feel like you're showing us life there. Can you talk about how you tried to, it seems like to me anyway, you kind of avoided both of those.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess it wasn't sort of conscious, in trying to avoid one thing or the other. I think my interest in photography stems from documentary work. And I was, as objective as I try to be about certain situations or the way I'm looking at things, I very much feel that my emotions are present and also just a huge part of what translates into the photos and how I feel and look at things. I guess there's not a whole lot of sentimentality or nostalgia, but I think that's inherent almost in a way to every photograph, because it's, it's sort of this external memory and looking at the past, even if it was yesterday, or, 5, 10, 20 years ago. But I think I just was really interested in sort of capturing the atmosphere that I felt when I went home, the starkness of the landscape, the way that people interact with it, and sort of the warmth that's present amongst such a cold period, literally the dormant season or the dormant period of the year. I found that tension to be really, really interesting. So yeah, and I think probably too, just with the edit and the way that it's all put together, it kind of removes you from that sort of nostalgic perspective and gives you more of a maybe straightforward look at it. As much as the emotions are involved and present in it, I think it's a little bit more straightforward than sentimental.
Talking to Erin Springer, photographer. Her new book is Dormant Season, which includes photos from her hometown, her home community, is just outside of Menominee here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Some of your photos are landscapes, some involve animals, but there are human subjects in them. And I understand some of them are relatives, some of them are not. How was it working with family and community members here?
Yeah. So the work started with my immediate family. I was making the photos initially when I would be home for Thanksgiving. And that was sort of just this, there wasn't real specific intention. That's the way I've always sort of interacted and participated in different family events. And I've always been just really compelled to capture the moments with my family. But then this work started growing into something that I felt was much bigger and should and could be expanded into the community. And, you know, the more time I spent with my family in sort of familiar settings, the more curious I was about foreign settings, even if it was just, you know, neighbors next door. You don't really realize how many times you might drive by a farm or see somebody in a town nearby that you don't know. And, you know, without approaching them or literally knocking on their door, you may never know about them or their life. And I really, I learned a lot from people that I would approach sort of at random. And it's definitely different challenges working with family versus community, and strangers, but, everybody that's in this work, I've developed a personal relationship with that I think will kind of carry on throughout my life. So I feel really, really fortunate for everybody that had their open doors to me. But yeah, it's just amazing, like how many different situations you can get in when you just let your curiosity sort of steer the way and follow your instincts and approach people. And, most often people are open and curious as well. Even if they're not familiar with the type of photography that I was interested in making, we had that sort of mutual interest in each other and what I was trying to do. And for me, you know, how they were living and who they are. So yeah, it worked out really well. I feel really, really fortunate to have worked with the people that I did and encountered in very unexpected ways.
I want to visit a couple of the photos here, and I'm looking at one right now, and this is selfish. I didn't grow up on the family farm, grew up visiting my great uncle's family farm, fond memories of time in the hayloft. And you've got a picture, mm-hmm. A bunch of kids, it's almost set up like an amphitheater in the hayloft there. Can you tell us a little bit about that image?
Yeah. So I guess to describe the picture a bit, so there's the group of kids are hanging out in the hayloft, which is the upper level of a barn, for anybody that might not be familiar. And there's two boys hanging from the rafters, and there's other kids and a cat seated on top of some stacked hay bales. And they're all talking amongst themselves. Nobody's making direct eye contact. And we're sort of just enveloped by this, amphitheater, like you said. When I first saw that scene, I thought, wow, this is like a cathedral. You know, the light is streaming in and, you know, the light's reflected from the particles in the hay and the air. I got to this image. It actually was a pretty long buildup to this because I was with my uncle and my cousin who were loading soybeans at this farm just a year prior. And I'd always driven, this is kind of the perfect classic example of what I was saying earlier, where I was always driving by this farm and I knew of the family that lived there, but I'd never actually been to the farm. So I went with my uncle and my cousin and just to spend time with them. And there was a bunch of kids running around the farmyard and, just struck up conversation with one of the teenagers. And I learned that there's a one-room school there with 15 or so kids, ages 6 to about 17. So every grade. And, within that conversation, I talked to the farmer that lives there, and his daughter has the school. And he told me that it was actually my great, great, great grandfather that built that barn. So I just thought, wow, like this is so how, you know, the things you learn just by asking a few questions. And, you know, this was only 5 miles from where I grew up, but I hadn't known that prior to that visit. So I sort of took that as a sign and I started spending time at the school the following year. I was really thinking about this, you know, I think I was on my way back to New York when I first met the kids at the school, and I was there on that initial visit with my uncle. But yeah, I really just kind of took this as a sign, and I was so curious about this. I just really wanted to explore what the school was like too. Just like the fact that there was kids learning on a school was, or sorry, learning on a farm was really interesting. So yeah, then I just went back the following fall and spent a lot of time with the kids, and that photo was made on their sort of recess lunch break. It was cold outside and they spend time in the barn and play with the kitties, and that was sort of where they congregate. And yeah, we just had a lot of fun, and I made that picture of them, and just really, yeah, it was a really special experience for me. And I really am really glad for that moment in that photo.
We're talking to photographer Erin Springer about her new book. It's called Dormant Season, which captures life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see beauty in rural Wisconsin life? The people, the places, the buildings, the landscapes? Do you try to capture those through photos or drawing or painting or writing? Do you have a favorite artist who portrays what life is like in the rural Midwest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with photographer Erin Springer about her new book, Dormant Season, a collection of photos of life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you try to catch images of rural Wisconsin on camera or painting or drawing or whatever you might do, love to hear from you what you like to draw. Join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Bruce in Two Harbors, Minnesota, who said, aside from loving living in a rural part of his state, he thinks the windmill is a great icon of rural landscape. I don't think you have windmills, Erin, but something that really kind of looms over the scenery a lot is the silo. I see that showing up in a few pictures, and that gives, I don't know, it gives like a height to some of the pictures. Can you talk about how you tried to bring silos into the, I'm looking at one right now, actually, with some birds doing a flyby.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really... I hadn't intentionally sort of thought about the incorporation of silos, but maybe there's a subconscious thread there of sort of the storage of memory. Maybe there's something there about, you know, the storage of crops that go into silos throughout the winter. And sort of this project is a sort of container of my memories and expression of my memories. Maybe that's a stretch, but if I had to give a top of mind answer, that might be something going on in my inner mind there.
I love it. We've got Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Well, hello, good afternoon. I've done the similar thing, moved away and came back. And what I found as I recall these memories, and I wanted to ask the artist here, as part of the creative process that goes into taking a photograph or a scene, does music play a part? Or even after you produce the photograph later, do certain songs remind you of certain scenes? Or as part of the creative process, how does music affect what you do?
Interesting question. Ooh. Jeff, Erin, what do you think?
Yeah, that is such an interesting question. I actually was listening to a song on repeat kind of while I was making this work. And I was really listening to a lot of classical music, a lot of piano and a lot of cello. And I spent so much time just driving around by myself in the landscape and the openness of the sort of winter fields and sky. And I found the classical music to be really, really helpful in sort of getting me into a zone of emotion and mood, and also kind of just creating a canvas for me to look at things without having words placed upon them. So the classical music I was listening to was all instrumental. And I thought that was really, it really was moving to me to, you know, watch snow drifting across the road, watching wind, watching just people from a distance while listening to music that has such such big crescendos and everything. I thought it was really, really helpful for me, but I hadn't really thought about it as part of the process. I think it was sort of, again, just like a subconscious thing that I would do when I would think of it, and I would sort of need another spark, you know, to get me into a mindset to make photos or feel a certain type of way.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. I can't leave it hanging, Aaron. What song were you listening to on repeat in particular?
I knew you were going to ask, and I need to, hold on. Let me pull this up here. Let's see. I've got I can never remember the name. It's one that I hadn't heard before I sort of put on a shuffle in classical music here. I've got a playlist. Sorry for the
here. It's actually just building the suspense for me. I don't know about anybody else.
I know. Here it is. Okay. It's by Anya Lechner, and it's called Vague, and then it's / En la Naveva. And it's from her album Lontano.
All right, we're gonna get a link on our segment note for that. Aaron, as we wrap up, just briefly, one thing that really strikes me, you put the photos in the book, you don't have captions, you don't have descriptions. What led to that decision, just letting those photos stand for themselves?
Well, I think it's important for viewers to have their own interpretation of the work. I think what you feel and what you glean from a body of visual work is as relevant as what maybe the artist did making it. And so I just really, the mystery of it and the openness and all the different forms that it can take on and the spaces that it can occupy in your mind, if you aren't overly explicative with things and you don't explain what's necessarily happening, I think can be really helpful for a visual project like this. You know, it's not specific to one person, one place, or even one story. It's really to evoke a feeling and convey sort of a more generalized mood. So I think I think not having captions and not having explanations is helpful for that.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Springer, a photographer based in Menominee here in Wisconsin and Brooklyn, the New York kind of Brooklyn, not our Wisconsin Brooklyn. Her work has been featured in the New Yorker and the New York Times. She was with us to talk about her new photo book, Dormant Season, with lots of pictures of places, people, and landscape near Menominee. This summer, biologists in Wisconsin completed a years-long survey of the state's wood turtle population. The threatened species lives mostly in the North Woods. As Rob Metzer reports, wood turtles have been in decline as they lost their nests to predators and as humans poach turtles to sell illegally.
We're good?
It's a cool North Woods morning in May, and a group of about a dozen people are on a field trip sponsored by the nonprofit Natural Resources Foundation. The plan is to kayak down a river where scientists from the Department of Natural Resources are conducting a population survey of wood turtles. Andrew Badgie is a conservation biologist. On a car ride to the kayak launch, he says the wood turtle is in trouble.
A lot of the nesting habitat no longer is natural in the state, and so a lot of the wood turtles the females will actually nest along the roadsides. And that's just a really easy avenue for raccoons and other predators to dig up the nests.
Wisconsin classifies wood turtles as a threatened species. This year, the DNR shared its latest population survey data with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They'll decide whether or not wood turtles should qualify as a federally endangered species. That decision is expected next spring. These turtles have distinctive, lined markings, almost like the rings of a tree. Badgie says that's made them attractive to another predator. Poachers.
Where people will go into sites and basically collect as many wood turtles as they possibly can and sell them illegally across the seas in China and Southeast Asia and even in the United States and Europe.
In 2020, the Malaysian government extradited a Chinese citizen to the U.S. He was found to be running a multi-million-dollar international turtle smuggling ring. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Badgie asked the WPR not give the exact location of the nesting sites to keep the information out of poachers' hands. The group paddles down the river, hoping to catch a glimpse of turtles sunning themselves. They stop at a shelter the DNR built to try to protect wood turtle nests from predators. Biologist Lena Carlson explains.
It's
made out of wood. It's surrounded by chicken wire. However, at the very bottom, there is a gap, probably the size of a 2x4, which is the exact height of a wood turtle. So only wood turtles can get in this box, and only wood turtles can get out of it.
Turtles are just coming out of hibernation in May. By June, they'll be looking for places to nest, and biologists hope they'll find these sites more attractive than the roadsides. Surveying the turtles is time-consuming and tricky. They don't just line up to be counted. There's a thunderstorm in the forecast today. Turtles can sense changes in barometric pressure, and they've made themselves scarce.
Do you want to check this one?
A few weeks later, another biologist, Carly Lapin, is out surveying nest sites not far from that same river. This time, there's no group of tourists. She and a trainee dig out some nests so they can count the number of eggs before carefully replacing them. She says the threat to this species from the illegal pet trade is very real.
The females congregate in these like nesting areas every spring, so it's really easy for someone to just go and grab a bunch of female turtles, and they can wipe out a whole population, you know, in one night.
Lapin wears mosquito netting as we hike through swampy areas and along sandy roads where wood turtles like to nest. Deep in the woods, we spot one. The turtle is digging in the sand with her back legs. Lapin says she's just picking out her nest site.
So she's not nesting yet. She's digging a hole.
Lapin takes down some data about the turtle and the nesting site. Now that we've disturbed her, Lapin says this turtle will probably wait at least a few hours before laying her eggs. It's already illegal to hunt or take wood turtles from the wild. If the species is granted federally endangered status, that would mean more funding for research and conservation efforts like these. Scientists say that's needed to keep the wood turtle population from dwindling further. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find that story and lots more online at WPR.org, including the latest from the WPR News Department, stories from Wisconsin Life, and of course, audio archives for the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Republicans in the Wisconsin State Legislature introduced a new package of proposals last week aimed at addressing what's been called a child care crisis here in the state. This comes after the legislature had rejected Governor Evers' proposal to use state surplus funds to extend child care counts, a pandemic-era program set to expire early next year. Critics of the proposed package of legislation say it wouldn't do enough to address the concerns of families or child care providers who have been overwhelmed with demand as parents return to working in person after the peak of the pandemic. But the bill's authors say the solutions they're proposing should get bipartisan support. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent, what are your experiences finding child care in Wisconsin? Did you find some? Was it affordable? Do you work as a child care provider? What kind of things would make the most difference for you in new child care legislation from the state? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Our next guests are Republican Assembly representatives and co-creators of these new proposals. Representative Joy Gobin represents District 5 in northeastern Wisconsin. Representative Gobin, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And Representative Karen Hurd represents District 68, just east of Eau Claire. Representative Hurd, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
There's a variety of things on the table here. Representative Gobin, first of all, can you talk about the parts of these proposals that would make childcare more accessible, that would change who can work, for example, in childcare, things like that?
Okay, well, my portion is I have five different bills. All of them are sort of geared toward accessibility. We have one bill has the state allows certified providers, but those certified providers are only being allowed to watch sort of half of what they do because half of their children that they can watch, they have up to six. Three of them can be related and three unrelated. And so this bill says they can watch six kids whether or not they are related. So it seems sort of common sense. Not sure why that was adopted to be as it is, but let's open up so that they can care for the full amount of children that their certification allows. We also have the creation of a new type of child care center, the large family child care center. I ran a family child care center. It's run in your home, and you can have up to eight children. But the large family center says, I can have an employee, and now I can have up to 12 children in my home child care center. Both of those would allow for some increased spots for child care, which is a great way to do it. We also have a bill about assistant child care teachers that young people, 16, can now count in the ratios if they have the education requirements. So we're not just putting anybody in there. They need to be, they need to have the coursework in early childcare so that they can count in the ratios. This is good for childcare centers because, so for example, you could have an apprenticeship, which would be a 16-year-old, but a childcare center isn't going to have an apprentice that doesn't count in their numbers because then they're paying someone to not help have more children. So that's another option there. Let's see, what else? We're adjusting the ratios slightly to try to make it allow more flexibility for centers in their ratios to create more spots, hopefully provide more income to child care workers.
And Representative Hurd, another piece on the table here is the idea of a loan fund for some local providers. What would we see there?
What we have is a 0% loan. So a child care center could apply for one of these 0% loans, and then it's a revolving loan. So if they pay it back, then we could offer the loan to others. We're going to put 60%, given that the bill goes through, of course, mm-hmm. We're going to require 60% of the 15 million. So if 15 million is what we're allocating, that 60% would go to in-home providers and 40% going to the centers. That would mean 300 family in-home facilities could get a $30,000 0% interest loan, and 60 of the larger child care facilities could get $100,000 as 0% interest-free loan. It's really would be great. So if you're thinking about, oh, I would like to, you know, have in my house a child care center, but I have to have a fence. Well, then you could use this 0% loan to get the fence and get that in, or whatever is needed to make your home a child care facility.
I want to ask each of you what you're hearing from constituents, those looking for childcare, those providing it. Representative Gobin, as you talk to people, what are you hearing?
I'm hearing there is a need for help in creating sustainable childcare. There are not enough slots. I just spoke to someone from my district who is a district administrator of the Hobart area, and he was talking to a childcare provider who said they're going to go out of business. But the reasoning is a little different than what some people are talking about, and it has to do with 4K. So the 4K, which there's a school right near that area, and they aren't able to the 4K takes off the four-year-olds. That makes it a lot harder because of ratios for that provider to make a living. So she's concerned that her center isn't going to be able to stay open or sustain it if they, for example, take 3K. So there's a drought of childcare, and we need to find ways to make it more accessible.
And how about in your part of the state, Representative Hurd?
It's the same that, you know, we're short, looking for slots for childcare. But these bills, I think, will really help out. As I've spoken to people in the area, they're very much excited about them. And they're not seeing as much of the child care closures as we thought that we were going to see. And so it's actually a very good thing. I think this is going to bring a lot of solutions to the people.
Representative Gobin, we've seen some criticism in the child care community and from your Democratic colleagues in the legislature that in effect, you're deregulating. You're changing the provider to kid ratio. You're loosening things up, and it's going to maybe threaten quality in childcare. What do you say to those concerns?
I think that's unfair When we look at other states, we are in line with other states, and we've actually tried to find out, are these other states, you know, having issues in quality? And we don't see that. Also, something to consider is that no one is forcing a child care to change their ratios. It's an option for flexibility. So whether or not they have, depending on the type of quality employees that they have, maybe these ratio changes are going to be great. Maybe they need to hold, for whatever reasons, to the ratios that they have now. It's offering, we're trying to offer flexibility, and that's what I think these bills do.
And finally, Representative Hurd, I mentioned Governor Evers had proposed using state budget surplus funding to keep this federal thing going. Do you see maybe of the Child Care Counts program, do you see a way to meet halfway, do some of what he was hoping for in his initial budget, get some of what you and your colleagues are hoping for in this package of proposals?
Well, we had, you know, Governor Evers, we had put this child care renovations loan in the original budget, and then Governor Evers vetoed out that it wouldn't be a loan program, it would just be to a child care fund. So basically to backfill that child care counts program. But we're putting back in the loan program because it'd actually be more helpful because it will give people more money. It keeps going back to the child care facilities. We don't run out of money and then, you know, we reach this cliff. We need to fix the whole broken system. This system in child care, it was broken long, long before COVID. And, you know, I've got the data going way back into the 80s, how this all occurred. And just even in 2013, before COVID, I mean, they were losing 200 to 400 child care facilities a year because the model's broken. And that's what these bills are trying to address, is to fix the broken child care business model so that it can sustain itself and doesn't need to have subsidiaries from the government being handed out, because that's not sustainable and it doesn't fix the problem. It's just a band-aid to the problem. We need to fix the cause.
We'll leave it there.
May I add to that?
Briefly, yes, go ahead.
Just note that our budget did spend $93 million on child care. So there were increases in the SHARES program, reaching out to those who have affordability issues. So there is a considerable amount of money coming from the state to different programs for child care.
Right. And it was $93 million all new money this budget. Overall, total spend in this biennial budget is $960 million in child care.
Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Republican Assembly Representative Joy Gobin and Karen Hurd about the new package of child care proposals introduced in the Wisconsin State Legislature. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert in child care programs. Alejandra Ross-Pilars is assistant professor in the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Alejandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alejandra, what are you seeing in the child care landscape? How big are the challenges?
Yeah, so as Representative Hurd said, the childcare system has been broken for many, many years, even before the pandemic. But the COVID pandemic really exacerbated already existing challenges. So let me explain. So on the one hand, many parents cannot access high quality early care and education. Even before the pandemic, there was a shortage of regulated childcare providers that parents could get to within a reasonable driving distance. But even when parents have childcare near their home, many can't afford the cost of it, which is as much as $13,500 per infant in a childcare center. And those who can afford the childcare are spending about 20% of their budget on average on childcare. So this puts a big strain on families' budgets. During the pandemic, we've seen childcare costs, especially in recent months, go up for families, and the price is rising more quickly than for other goods and services. So parents are having a hard time. And then the second key thing to know is that childcare workers are highly educated and highly trained workers, but are extremely undercompensated given their education and skills. So when the COVID pandemic started, many centers closed, family childcare providers closed, some permanently, some temporarily. Childcare workers, some of them lost their jobs, some of them went to work in other sectors for higher pay. So the childcare industry has not fully recovered. Even today, we're short about 40,000 workers compared to before the pandemic nationally. So part of the reason that the sector is struggling so much in retaining workers is because they are so undercompensated. So, for example, in Wisconsin, childcare workers, most of them have more than a high school education, an associate's degree or bachelor's degree, but are making only $13 an hour. That's $3 less than the average worker with only a high school education. So they are extremely undercompensated, and that makes it really difficult when to keep them in the sector when they can earn a higher wage in other industries. There's substantial turnover in the sector. It makes it difficult for childcare providers to staff their childcare centers and family childcare homes. So things are challenging as it is, and the Childcare Counts program really is keeping the sector afloat. This is funded with pandemic relief funds, which are set to expire in 2024. And so the concern is that things are already and sort of precarious in the sector as it is. And when those funds expire, childcare providers are using those funds right now to pay their workers more without raising prices for parents. And so when those funds expire, workers might leave for other sectors because compensation will go down, or providers will close, or parents will end up paying more for care. So those are sort of the current state of what's happening in the sector. And that's why we really need more investments of funding into the sector to fix the broken financing.
We're talking to Alejandra Ross-Pilar, assistant professor in the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at UW-Madison, looking at the challenges facing childcare here in the state, possible policy solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the legislation we heard from a pair of state lawmakers a little while ago? Do you work in childcare? What would help you the most if you're a parent having trouble finding childcare? You can get to or afford. Love to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Alejandra Ross-Pilar, assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison, looking at the latest package of child care bills proposed by Republicans in the Wisconsin state legislature and how they fit into bigger trends we're seeing around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alejandra, picking up where you left off, child care costs a lot for parents. The people providing it don't make a lot of money doing it. Apart from putting state or federal money into it, are there changes that could make the industry more sustainable?
The key thing really is fixing this funding issue. And the research shows that what is effective for shoring up the childcare sector is, one, increasing compensation for workers. So we have research that shows that providing financial incentives to stay in the sector, increasing compensation, is going to reduce turnover and allow workers to stay in the sector and not leave for other higher paying jobs. And so right now, funding from Childcare Counts is being used to allow childcare workers to receive a stipend of up to $1,900 per year. That would, you know, that's on top of what their wages are from their childcare center or family childcare home. And so that, again, would have to be reduced or go away entirely once the funding runs out. And so we know those things are really effective at reducing turnover, at keeping workers in the sector. And then the second key thing that we know from the research is that increasing funding for childcare, for example, through the childcare subsidy program, would have big effects on reducing out-of-pocket costs for parents, would increase employment among mothers, and would increase wages by providers for up to 30%. So those are the things that we know from the research that are effective at helping the childcare sector, be stronger and have parents be able to access high quality care.
We got an email from Leah who writes, "My husband and I have been on wait lists since April, and we might get into full-time childcare by February of next year, which is causing lots of issues with our employment." This is in South Central Wisconsin, Leah writes. So not just unaffordable childcare, Alejandra, but not able to get into childcare, period. Do we have places in the state where even if you can't afford it, you can't find childcare?
Definitely. So, you know, the access to care really varies a lot across the state. What we know is that the number of slots per child is better in urban areas. So there's a 1.7 children per childcare slot in urban areas compared to about 3.4 in rural areas. So there are places in that it's a little bit easier. That said, it's much harder to find care for infants and toddlers. And part of the reason for that is it's more expensive. It's both for parents, but also for childcare centers to provide that care. And so they don't make as much, you know, per child, because you need small ratios in order for that care to be safe and high quality. And so finding infant and toddler care is a challenge across the state. You just heard that a lot from parents, and there are long wait lists, especially for those younger kids.
In that package of new legislation, I was talking to state lawmakers about, they would change the standards, allow a little change to staff to student ratio that they say other states are already doing, making it easier for younger people to get involved in childcare. Do you think changes like that could help solve the problem?
Yeah, fundamentally, what we need is increased investment in the sector. It's hard to know exactly whether those what effects that those proposed changes would have. What we do know is that you know, it's unclear if providers would actually change their ratios to have more kids per staff. There are many centers are accredited by national organizations that have these lower ratios. And so increasing their ratios would put them out of accreditation. It might cause them to lose their quality rating in the Young Star system, which is the statewide system that provides ratings to childcare providers so that parents know what quality care they're getting. So if they increase their ratios, they might not be able to, or they might face unintended consequences from that. The other key thing about that is that, you know, childcare workers, as I said, are already undercompensated. They experience high burnout. And so you would be adding more to their plate, having them care for more children, bigger group sizes. And so it's not clear that, you know, this might have, you know, an adverse effect on increasing turnover if workers are just burnt out and decide that, you know, if they're not getting compensated more for doing more work, that they will, you know, just decide to leave for other higher paying jobs that are less burdensome.
Alejandra, we've talked about the impact on parents, the impact on childcare providers. How about kids? What do we know about access to quality childcare programs and what it means for kids as they grow up?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. We know a good amount about this question. And so the research on this is very clear. There's a wealth of evidence that high quality and affordable early care and education promotes children's development. There's benefits both in the short term to their learning and, you know, in preschool, in kindergarten, in early years, and longer term, children who attend high quality early care education also do have a higher educational attainment. They more likely graduate college, they have higher earnings, and they're healthier as adults. So all of these things are, you know, obviously great benefits for kids, for them in the long run, but also for society, because society also reaps benefits from having a healthier and more educated workforce down the line. So this is really an area where we know if we make these investments when kids are young, we will reap the benefits down the line as a society. So it's really an issue that is important for all of us, not just those with young kids, but for everyone who will benefit from this down the road.
Alejandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Alejandra Ross-Pilars is an assistant professor in the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us for a closer look at new legislation that proposes to address gaps in Wisconsin's child care system. Earlier, we heard from two state lawmakers, Joy Gobin and Karen Hurd, both Republicans in the Assembly. They have a package of legislation aimed at tackling at least part of this problem. You can read more about that online at WPR.org. Our news team has been covering that. And if this is something that affects your life, there is still time for you to weigh in. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did you have success in finding childcare? Was it childcare you pay for or something you worked with a family member on, maybe? That's parents. How about caregivers? Do you work as a child care provider or run some kind of child care, big or small? Love to hear what you're seeing and what you think might help you and your situation. As always, you can email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. Love to see your stories. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, find out how our plastic recycling system works. It can be confusing. Does this go in? Does this not? And get advice on how we can do it more efficiently and effectively by changing the system. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sure, you could send a message in a bottle, but how about a message in an egg carton? This has been making its way through the news, initially reported, as far as I can tell, by KCCI News in Des Moines, Iowa. Back in 1951, a young woman packing eggs into cartons wrote a note on one of them with her name and city and the message, "Whoever gets this egg, please write." She got her wish last month, 70 plus years later. The egg went to New York City. The buyer kept it as a curiosity. For reasons I don't fully understand, it didn't rot. It just sort of petrified. He gave it to a neighbor. The neighbor posted on a Facebook site this summer. Word spread, and yes, the current owner of the egg made contact 7 decades later with a now 92-year-old woman who wrote the note. I think I speak for everybody when I say, please, don't eat that egg. This is Central Time.